Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case today, 2023-0539, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Macklin. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Van, it's my understanding you're sharing your time with Mr. Keller.
That's correct, Your Honor. The State of Ohio is going. We're going to give 5 minutes to the Solicitor General's office to argue in the opening. And I would like to reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
So you want 2 minutes for rebuttal, but the Solicitor General is going to take five minutes of your opening.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
With that being said, Your Honor, good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court. My name is Daniel Van. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Cuyahoga County, appearing on behalf of the State of Ohio. State of Ohio is asking this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals below, insofar as the 8th District held that in this case that the General Division lacked jurisdiction to consider charges beyond those specific counts for which the juvenile court found probable cause. The specific counts at issue in this case was a conspiracy count involving the aggravated robbery of Hesham Kamel. During the course of this aggravated robbery, and this was a robbery that had been set up through an offer up through social media, Mr. Kamel was shot and killed during the course of this conspiracy. And I think what this case does is it really highlights better than what we had in Smith the lifespan of a criminal case. It shows how the evidence, what we might present at the probable cause hearing in juvenile court, a preliminary hearing, can evolve to what we can ultimately possibly present to a grand jury and later at trial. Specifically in this case, what we had at the ultimate trial was testimony from 16 witnesses. These witnesses included co-defendants who were able to testify specifically about the conspiracy. They were able to testify specifically about Mr. Macklin's involvement in this case. And so I think with that understanding, I think it was the grand jury's indictment here was appropriate, given that the juvenile court found probable cause as to the act of murder.
So we're going to hear, we've heard the Taylor case.
Correct.
Is there anything different than this from this case than Taylor? Is Taylor going to control, or whatever we decide in Taylor, is that going to control here?
So I think Taylor controls part of this case. I think Taylor will control the outcome with respect to the conspiracy count. One thing that we did raise as being an issue in this case that's not at issue in Taylor, it's not at issue in Williams, is the fact that we had an aggravated murder count. Granted, later the jury acquitted the defendant of the aggravated murder. But the question still remains, was the grand jury able to return that, return an indictment on that count? And it just all goes back to the idea of what is a case. And I think
if he was acquitted, that's really, it's really kind of moot, isn't it? It is moot.
I think I would agree, Your Honor. Yes, the defendant here was acquitted of aggravated murder, and what we took specific issue with was the holding from the court on subject matter jurisdiction, indicating that the that this should have never gone to the grand jury to begin with. And I do think that's problematic to the extent that we had the act charged, which was murder. It was the death of Hesham Kamel. And I think if we consider what this court had held in Burns, the rooted in language, which really is a representation of what the 8th District had held in prior cases, the idea of a course of conduct. And in this case, what we have, the act of murder, it's all the same act. It's all related to the aggravated robbery. It's related to the conspiracy. They're all part of the same act.
So should we reverse the case and send it to the Court of Appeals to apply Burns?
I believe so, or I think the court can simply vacate the portions of the decision in which the 8th District held that this was an issue of subject matter jurisdiction in the court, general division. Lacked subject matter jurisdiction over the aggravated murder count and the conspiracy count. I think, and I say that because and these arguments were raised in the Taylor case, the fact that if you can waive probable cause, if you can waive amenability, if you can waive those, then how can this be subject matter jurisdiction? And I do think, the arguments that we set forth are still consistent with the statutory provisions, speaking of transferring the act over to the general division. And so what can the grand jury do with that? And I think the grand jury should be able to consider all the evidence that the prosecutor has, perhaps evidence that the state was unable to present in juvenile court, and return a proper indictment related to the starting point, the act that the juvenile court had transferred over.
So what do you think the case is now after the changes to the statute?
That's a fair point. And
no, it's a question.
Well, that's a fair question. And I think where we're at is it's hard to apply some of the new statutes, specifically when we look at 2152.022. So we have divisions B1 and B2 of that statute. B1 speaks of the counts in which there was probable cause. That goes over to the general division. The counts that aren't transferred are the ones in which the court, juvenile court, found no probable cause.
So does the Common Pleas Court have jurisdiction over those counts that were not transferred?
I would say this, and I...
That's a yes or no question.
Yes, in my view, and I think we also, it's also problematic.
That's not what the statute says now, so how can you say that?
I think where I struggle with the statute and understanding how this works in this case is that we have one homicide offense. There's a greater offense and there's a lesser offense. And so if you were to try to read, if you read the statute strictly and apply it, I'm not sure how the greater offense stays behind in juvenile court and the lesser offense of murder.
Well, I think you're really talking about the act, though, aren't you? Not the offense, because the offense, an act can be charged a multitude of ways. But aren't you really talking about the act?
Yes, that's precisely my arguments here, the act here of murder. And so I believe that once the general division has that act of murder under 2151.23H, the court is, the general division is able to look at and even accept pleas, accept verdicts for lesser offenses, or even different offenses.
That was part of the confusion with the prior statute. But after Smith, the statute was changed, and the word act is not operative, it's case. So how are you going to deal with that?
I think we still have in the statute an indication that in 2151.12i mentions that the transfer abates a jurisdiction with respect to the act charge. So there's still mention of the words act charged in portions of the revised code. And when we go back to 2151.23h, much of that same language is still there about what happens now. So,
but is there any time, any point in time before the juvenile court binds over this young person to that court for adjudication, is there any time before that that the Common Pleas Court would have jurisdiction for someone under 18?
Not until, when we're talking about one, and I would say this, when we're talking about one criminal incident, the transfer occurs when the juvenile court finds probable cause as to one of those acts that form the basis of that incident.
Let me ask a question. Do you think now that the statute has changed, if you had a felonious assault that you wanted to bind over to the adult court, but at the probable cause hearing, the juvenile court judge failed to find probable cause as to a gun spec, do you believe that you would be able to still present a probable cause on that same gun spec to the grand jury now that case has been defined?
I think that's going to be a little different under the circumstance because the gun spec might take that outside the realm of mandatory transfer. That's still be discretionary. And obviously, you know, in that circumstance, if it's transferred over as a, you know, discretionary, there's still room for the case to evolve where maybe there's additional evidence indicating possession or brandishing of a firearm.
What if there wasn't any additional evidence, though?
I think that would leave prosecutors in a position of trying to figure out how to proceed going forward. If they get additional evidence, do they go back to juvenile court to get a new complaint and start all over again? And you could say the same thing in this case. If the state had obtained additional evidence supporting probable cause as to the ag murder, now you have a case that's already been transferred with the murder, does the prosecutor start anew with ag murder, even though we already have a case that's been transferred over? So, you know, there's a lot of procedural nuance here that I struggle a bit to kind of navigate the statutes, especially in a case such as this.
So well into the state's time, if you want the state to have a say.
Sure, yes, and with that being said, you know, I would ask the court to reverse the decision below insofar as the court below held that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you.
Mr. Keller.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I hope to do two things with my limited time here today. One is to identify a distinction that I think helped explain where we're at this point. And the second is to correct a false impression that at least I read Macklin's brief as giving about the legislative timeline for the recent statutory amendments. So the distinction is this. We have to distinguish between charges that were included in the juvenile complaint and charges that were never presented in juvenile court. For charges that were included in the complaint, we look at the rules that give Smith and the new 0.022 statute give us, and they tell us that bind over requires an affirmative probable cause finding. But for charges that were never presented in the juvenile court, that's when we look to Burns and the 0.23H statute. And those are the set of rules that apply to conspiracy charge here. And you are allowed to add, the state is allowed to add charges so long as, at least as long as the charge arises from the course of events that led to the transfer. That distinction helps explain why Smith and Burns are entirely reconcilable. It helps explain why the different parts of the statute are doing different work. And also importantly here, it helps explain why the statutory amendments did nothing to upset Burns. I do want to focus specifically on Burns a little bit. With all the disagreement in this area, it might be easy to to not remember that this court was actually unanimous in Burns in reading 0.23H to allow for the state to add new charges after transfer. And stare decisis receives particular force when it comes to statutory interpretations. So I think that we're not starting fresh here when it comes to reading the statutes. Now, the way I think Macklin tries to get around stare decisis is by saying, well, the statutory amendments abolished Burns. That's wrong both as a matter of text and timeline. The text point is simple. The statutory amendments did not change the operative language of 0.23H that led the court to hold as it did in Burns. They added a cross-reference to the 0.022 statute, but going back to the distinction I flagged, all that 0.022 statute tells us is what to do with charges that were included in the juvenile complaint. It has nothing to say either way about charges that were never presented. Now, the timeline point that I flagged in opening, Senate Bill 288, if you go look at the legislative timeline, was drafted at least by December 14th, 2022. That's when it passed out of both houses of the General Assembly. This court did not decide Burns until 9 days later on December 23rd. So there is no way that the General Assembly was in direct dialogue with Burns. And when you combine that timeline point with the lack of a change to the operative text of 23H, I think that defeats any argument that the statutory amendments repudiated Burns.
Do you think we should reverse and send it to the appellate court for application of Burns?
I think you should reverse. I think the application of Burns' rooted in requirement is so obvious in this case that you should just order the reinstatement of the conspiracy charge. I actually maybe I'll get corrected by my friend on the other side, but I don't even read their brief as arguing that if Burns actually applies, that we don't meet the standard. We have here a plan to commit a car theft with a gun that all occurred on the same day with little to no pause. So I think naturally the conspiracy charge is rooted in the acts that led to transfer.
Do you think that we can possibly harmonize Burns with the statute? Because what was in 2125 or 2151.23 before and remains in the statute after Senate Bill 288 is the language that essentially whether the talking about the case whether the conviction is for the same degree or a lesser degree of the offense charged, for the commission of a lesser included offense, or for the commission of another offense that is different from the offense charged, would it be possible to harmonize Burns and this language with that very last phrase, or for the commission of another offense that is different from the offense charged, with the rooted in language?
I do think harmony is possible. I see I'm into my red. The first point I would make is a point of precedent. Burns already read that 23H statute to allow for the addition of charges, so we're not reading the statute fresh. But if I may go on with my answer.
You may finish.
So if you break down the structure of 23H, it starts with a general rule, and that's the idea that the adult court has the authority in the same manner as it would as in an original case after transfer. So that's the general rule. Then the statute goes on to provide a non-exhaustive list of the examples. But even if we're only looking at those examples, the last example tells us what happened was okay here. And that's because it allows for a verdict on a different offense that is an offense. It's not just a different offense. We know from the list it's not a lesser included offense and it's not a lesser degree offense. And the only way I know of that sequence permissibly happening is if the state's allowed to add a charge along the way that leads to a verdict on a different offense.
Or if there's a resolution of a case where there's a conviction, but it may be a different charge, but rooted in the same actions and activities that for which the original charges were made.
I think to reach a verdict on a different offense that is not a lesser included offense or a lesser degree offense, you need to add the charge at some point along the way.
I understand. I'm thinking more of a plea.
Yeah, but the statute separately addresses both pleas and verdicts, and it doesn't give any reason to think that the verdict language doesn't apply to that last example. So I think it certainly acknowledges the possibility of a verdict for a different offense. I'm sorry, I know I've gone well over time at this point.
Thank you for humoring me on that.
Good morning, Mr. Carvalho.
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court, Frank Cavallo on behalf of Demetrius Macklin. Your Honors, I struggle to understand how the state can make this case as Byzantine and complex as they appear to believe that it is. I would encourage you, as the lawyers who have come before you before, as Justice DeWine's pointed out in Taylor and another case, Williams, I believe, making essentially the same argument, that this is not at all a complicated situation. This is a simple matter of reading the text of the statute. And if you read the text of the statute, you have the answer. The General Assembly has given us a definition of case in the context of what gets transferred to the adult court in a juvenile court bind-over proceeding.
So how do you reconcile Burns?
We believe that Burns was decided before that statute was passed, 2152.022. Burns was decided after Smith, essentially in a vacuum in terms of whether there was a definition for the term case. Smith wrestled with this issue, this court wrestled with this issue in Smith. Burns went further to try to figure out, again, in the absence of a statutory definition, what does the case mean, what gets transferred, what can we say about what goes down to juvenile, what goes from juvenile court to adult court. It's no longer necessary. It is essentially abrogated by the passage of 2152.022, which tells us in no uncertain terms that what gets transferred to the adult court are charges for which the juvenile court found probable cause and found the matter over. That is the case. That is what gets transferred to the adult court. It is no longer necessary for this court to engage in any sort of determination to interpret what case might mean because we have a definition of it now. In Smith, in fact, this court said, had the legislature intended the term case to have as consequential a meaning as the state suggests, it would have made that clear intention by explicitly defining the term. And that was well before that statute was passed. That is part of what was going on at the time with this court and lower courts were struggling to interpret what charges can be included in a bindover. Is it just what's presented to the court in juvenile, what the court finds probable cause for? Is there some avenue in which you can find charges that are rooted in those charges, can later be presented to the grand jury? There's a tremendous amount of ambiguity associated with that. 2152.022 removes that ambiguity and says the case is just that. It is what the juvenile court finds probable cause for and only that. There's no longer any need to engage in a rooted in analysis. There's no longer any need to struggle with what that means. That is now the law in Ohio. And that is essentially returning back to what the court was struggling with in Smith, but it is a codification of what Smith was talking about in terms of what you send down to the adult court and a limitation on that. That is all that there is that goes to the adult court.
Do you think our decisions in Taylor or Williams decides this case?
Fundamentally, I think they're all basically the same issue. I mean, the specifics of what went on in each individual case may be a little bit different, and the application to each individual fact pattern is maybe, you know, case specific. But yeah, I think I put that in my brief. I mean, the one point of agreement that I had with the Attorney General's office, I believe, is that I think those decisions are essentially on all fours with this. This is the issue. I think if you decide that issue, I think that encompasses the issue in this case as well.
So my last question to Mr. Keller, when we were talking about in the statute for the commission of another offense that is different from the offense charged, and he distinguished that by saying it's not just a plea, but it would apply to a verdict as well. But haven't there been situations where in the middle of a trial or at the beginning of a trial, there's a need to amend the indictment, which could result in a different offense than what originally came up from the juvenile court having been bound over? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, What do you think the breadth or the application is of this language, or for the commission of another offense that is different from the offense charged?
Well, this court talked about that in the Smith case also. So, I mean, I take my guidance from that as well. And I can give you my opinion, but I think I'm reading off of what this court already told us. But that, to me, and given the language in Smith, that language is there to say that the General Assembly has to define everything in this context, because the juvenile court is the court of original jurisdiction for all cases involving someone, allegation of a criminal offense for someone under the age of 18. When you are going to transfer those cases to the adult court, the General Assembly has to define every power that is then ceded to the adult court, or everything would remain with the juvenile court. So what the General Assembly is doing, I think, with that statute, and what Smith talks about, is it's a definitional statute to say you're basically in a position to resolve that case the way that you would be able to have resolved the case if it had originated in adult court. So if you're going to accept a verdict on something, if it's going to be a plea negotiation that results in a different offense, you're empowered to accept a verdict on that. You are empowered now to handle that. It doesn't mean that you can go and start all over again and wipe the slate clean and go back to the grand jury and seek all new charges or start from scratch. If that were the case, pardon the pun, the statute that defines case would be meaningless. You're reading two statutes, the state would read two statutes here in a way that frustrates the operation of really one or both of them. That can't be right. The plain language of the statute, if you read it for what it's meant to do and you read it for what it says, gets you a very simple resolution to this case and to Taylor and Williams. And that is the answer here, I think. There's no reason to get involved in the complexities of cross-referencing statutes. And in the state in their brief talks about, well, if you can infer from the language what the General Assembly was trying to say that you could do. Well, there's no reason to engage in inference drawing if the General Assembly is very clear in what they're telling you consists of a case. There's no reason to resort to that. So I would say the plain language of the statute here carries the day. That is the answer.
Thank you.
Well, let me change the hypothetical then. Person's charged with murder, bind over, sent over to the grand jury, probable cause. Later it's found that they actually killed the second person, but it wasn't known at the time of the bindover. Are you saying that the state has to go back to the juvenile court to hear that charge before it's bound over to the grand jury for the second death?
At the risk of seeming too cute, Your Honor, I would say I'm not telling you that, but the General Assembly and the statute.
So you're saying that's what that statute says?
Yes. The juvenile court is the court of original jurisdiction by statute of any offense alleged against someone under the age of 18 in Ohio. If the state later believes that a second offense has been committed, it must
same
go back.
Bullet. I'm saying just they didn't know the person had died.
Yeah. I mean, that's not me. I think that's the way the statute operates, and that's the law.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I will yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van, your time is over, but I will give you a minute to address and rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two quick points, hopefully. First of all, reference to Senate Bill 288, I would direct the court to the legislative history, which indicates that Senate Bill 288 was passed by the legislature and I believe sent to the governor just a day before this court decided Burns. Now, to my second point, I think why we're here today, and it's seeking guidance from this court. How do we navigate all these statutes together? Because if I heard correctly from Mr. Cavallo, he seems to argue on the one hand the meaning of case should be limited, but at the same time seems to acknowledge the provisions of 2151.23H, which would allow an outcome for a verdict or a plea of a different offense. And we're still seeing cases of pleas in which these challenges are being raised. This court has actually has one, Tavante Turner, which is being held, And to kind of just completely understand kind of our navigation of this particular case. This is all one criminal episode. If this court were to go back to the bindover transcripts and look at the testimony of a special agent who had testified, gave a summary of the case, there were evidentiary objections raised. There were confrontation clause type arguments raised, and there's some preclusion of evidence, things that the juvenile court wouldn't consider. And so how does that come in play in this framework, where there are definitely things the state could have presented, but for one reason or another was not considered by the juvenile court? How do we navigate that going forward? And I think this is part of kind of our dilemma, trying to navigate this going forward. What do we do with this aggravated murder count?
So is this a particularized argument, or do you think this is something that's a general issue?
I think everything, I would say this, I think every new case this court hears, it's a different set of circumstances, which helps the court better understand readings of statutes. We've seen it with the Allied Offense statute. How many times has the court reinterpreted that statute to understand that statute in the specific context of the case? So I think this case just presents another set of circumstances to help us navigate and understand all these statutes. And I do think the aggravated murder here, the conspiracy here, that was all rooted in the murder, that act charge. And so we would ask the court to reverse the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.